Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
The whole scale of it is just, it's mesmerising. All of those bodies and all of the families.
World of Secrets, Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the documentary Erasing Hong Kong from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul French, a writer on China, and we're looking at the battles in the ongoing memory wars in Hong Kong.
As the idiom goes, the fight against tyranny is the fight against forgetting.
Glory to Hong Kong, the unofficial anthem of the 2019 Hong Kong democracy protests. It rang out through the streets, shopping malls and subway stations of the territory throughout the demonstrations between June 2019 and mid-2020. Today, 4 years later, you'd likely be arrested under Hong Kong's new national security law for singing that song in public, as well as maybe wearing a black T-shirt in the wrong place at the wrong time, or having a picture of a Tiananmen Square massacre commemorative candle on your phone. The authorities are actively attempting to erase and rewrite history, both the recent history of pro-democracy protest, as well as Hong Kong's 180-year-old history as a British colony. But Erasing Hong Kong is also the story of how ordinary people are trying to resist and preserve their historical narratives from erasure, even as the laws preventing them fighting back are tightened ever further. Protest leader and former elected Hong Kong legislator Nathan Law, now in exile in London.
Before 2020, the Chinese authority was not as aggressive in reshaping Hong Kong's culture, way of life, or even memories.
I go to work each day and you notice things slowly change.
Tom Grundy, editor-in-chief of the Hong Kong Free Press, one of the last truly independent media organisations left in the city.
In some cases, you literally see the erasure because you will see evidence on a street lamp of a faded sticker or a botched effort to remove some graffiti that once called for democracy. Or you'll just see a smudge on the side of a wall and you will know what that means.
It does seem like the government's pursuit of civic memory, public memory, knows no boundaries.
Mary Hui is a Hong Kong-based writer for the online news service Quartz.
It makes sense. If I were an authoritarian government, I would similarly go after people's memories. And that's exactly what they're doing.
I, for 2 years, have been walking past a restaurant and I didn't realise if I looked up, there was a universal suffrage sticker from 2014. There was a huge citywide effort to rid all evidence of that kind of thing. But even in the wider scope of this skyscraper-lined city, there is a feeling and a sense and visual clues that it has changed permanently and dramatically. You can feel it and you can see it.
Right now in Hong Kong, there is a struggle to decide who ultimately gets to control memory, history, what happened in Hong Kong's past, and most urgently, the struggle of Hong Kong people to make their voices heard despite severe restrictions and the threat of arrest and jail time. Louisa Lim is a writer who has long covered Hong Kong.
At the moment, I think the focus is on stopping any acts of memorial, no matter how small they are. I think it's interesting that despite the fact that it's been banned, we still see these acts of memorial, people graffitiing candles on walls and stuff like that.
Never has Hong Kong's history been so volatile and contested as in the last decade. Shabani Mattani was based in Hong Kong for the Washington Post, observed the pro-democracy movement up close, and is the co-author of a book about the protests, Among the Braves.
In 2014, Beijing tried to mandate the way Hong Kong's leader would be chosen. Hong Kong has always had this promise to them from the handover, which was in 1997, that they would one day eventually be able to select their own leader. But Beijing handed down a white paper that said, we have to pre-screen any candidates before you vote on them. And that galvanized a massive protest movement that was already brewing in opposition to the control Beijing was trying to exert over Hong Kong. It coalesced into this massive street protest, lasted for 79 days, led and mobilized in a big way by young people and Hong Kong students. And that's when you saw the rise of Joshua Joshua Wong and Nathan Law and others who took to the stage and took this big leadership role.
The protests flared up once more. Nathan Law found himself on the front line.
In 2019, the largest and most dramatic protest took place in Hong Kong. Beijing wanted to introduce the extradition treaty in Hong Kong so that they can extradite anyone in Hong Kong who seemed to have broken the law, including the democratic activist, back to mainland China. It triggered a huge concern in our society. In 2020, when the COVID emerged, the government had a convenient excuse to extend its emergency power to shut down all the protesters or even gathering of people.
And the most crucial element in all this was the introduction of the sweeping national security law. The Hong Kong government sent us a statement that its introduction was necessary to prevent, quote, external forces and anti-China disruptors who sought to destroy the rule of law, public order and political system, seriously endangering national security. Human rights should be respected and protected. The effect has been to transform chaos into order, end quote.
The national security law was something Beijing was planning and thinking about already towards the end of 2019. But they realized that COVID was a real opportunity to push this and push this fast because the momentum on the streets had quietened down. This law essentially created four very vague, very new crimes in Hong Kong that mirrored some of the national security violations in mainland China. These basically worked to sort of criminalize pretty much any form of dissent and speech you can think of that would be anti-government.
Things have been going missing in Hong Kong, all kinds of things. Statues, archives, museum exhibits, newspapers, and books. A lot of books. So, just to let you know, if you're wondering about the typing sounds, I'm filling out a form I downloaded from the website of the innocuous-sounding Hong Kong Leisure and Cultural Services Department. Mostly ordinary forms. Swimming pool tickets, booking badminton courts, and this one here. A form to report books that contravene the national security law. And it says, members of the public are welcome to express their view on library collections to ensure that the collections do not contain objectionable contents, such as those which exaggerate violence, pornography and vulgarism, violate the laws of Hong Kong or endanger national security. Please complete the form below. Items marked with an asterisk are required fields. So let's type Louisa Lim, the author of Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. All about the city and its people at the time of mass protest and change.
After the national security legislation was imposed on Hong Kong, my book was still available, but then for a while it was kind of siloed, put in a special portion of the library, but you couldn't take it home with you. And then one day in 2023, it just disappeared and that was it. It was gone. And that was a really sobering moment. I'll be honest, everybody thought that the moment might come, but then to have something just kind of vaporize, just disappear as if it had never existed was quite a moment because, of course, my writing has been all about amnesia and erasure. To be erased myself was another layer of erasure that I didn't really expect.
Louisa's experience is personal, but it's far from the only book that's gone missing. In September 2022, five Hong Kong speech therapists were jailed for 19 months each, guilty of publishing seditious kids' books. The authorities interpreted the books about some sheep trying to hold back a pack of wolves from attacking their village as referring to Hong Kong and the Beijing government, which perhaps tells you more about the censors than it does about the authors. The speech therapists maintained they were meant to help children understand ideas of systemic injustice. Judge Kwok Wai Kin accused the authors of sowing the seeds of instability in the city and across China. So off to jail they went. And all these books missing from library shelves, where do they go? And why can't you just visit a bookshop and buy a copy? Tom Grundy.
When you talk about books that the government considers sensitive being pulled from library shelves, we have sought to gain access to a list of what titles may be sensitive and which are being removed. They literally bin them, recycle them. I think they retain one copy. There have been hundreds of examples. Some are obvious, like the ones that refer to the Tiananmen crackdown. Others less so. I mean, we've seen romantic essays by Democrat or travel books by pro-democracy journalists being removed. The government says that even saying which books that they are pulling would present a national security risk in itself. So books disappear from public libraries, from primary and secondary school libraries, from state-controlled bookstores. chief executive John Lee will say, well, you could go to a private bookstore. But what private bookstore is going to be stocking these titles that have basically been flagged? Or because there isn't a specific list, they are likely going to feel some pressure to self-police. If it's not for that reason, they will find themselves facing other kinds of pressure as an independent bookstore in Hong Kong. They may get a visit in the space of a week from the Food and Environmental Hygiene Department, from the Buildings Department, from the Fire Services Department.
But it's not just books. It's also the visual and audio records of history that are disappearing too. Imagine if here at the BBC, we began totally erasing our archives of the last few years. Well,
RTHK, the public broadcaster here, said they would start wiping their archives of anything older than a year. And this led people to race against the clock to try and preserve copies of these articles, of these videos, what people said, what people did, and how events were recorded. To my knowledge, this has never happened before. Things would just stay on the RTHK archive. But for whatever reason, in 2021, public broadcasters decided that they no longer wanted all the articles to stay. And of course, this was conveniently timed to be about 2 years after the protest.
So if we were to go to the RTHK website or their YouTube channel now, all that stuff is just gone?
Exactly. A lot of dead links. If you are clicking on from other references to all the stories, those links no longer work. The original copies are gone.
But as soon as the news leaked out, there was a rushed but coordinated attempt by Hong Kongers to save the RTHK archive.
So there are various ways, I think, that people try to archive and document. So one is to just download onto your own computer, or you use something like webarchive.org, the Wayback Machine, that kind of thing, and to do it manually. Of course, that itself is, one, quite time-consuming, and two, if you have it on your own personal laptop, you might have a complete collection of all the articles, but what if some other researcher somewhere else wants to access it? So one tech professional in Hong Kong came up with was to try and use a decentralized registry to essentially create a digital fingerprint so that that metadata can be stored on a shared blockchain registry and particular digital fingerprint can then track whether changes are made.
Those backing up the RTHK archive remained anonymous. Potentially, they could be prosecuted under the national security law. Tom Grundy at the Hong Kong Free Press has watched what happened at RTHK and now worries about other crucially important historical records.
The online archive of press releases and the legislative Hansard, the minutes from way back to colonial times in both cases, remain online at the moment. But in some cases, it could be happening now. Things disappear quietly without people knowing. You can't monitor everything all of the time.
But it's not just books and digital archives, but also the material evidence of history. Those more ephemeral artifacts of the umbrella protests that are now ending up in new archives of the protest movement created in New York and Amsterdam, as well as in London's Victoria and Albert Museum. Catherine Flood was a curator on the V&A's 2014 exhibition, Disobedient Objects, which showcased physical items from the suffragettes to the Occupy movement.
We won't go home! We won't! Not only me, all of us here!
And so we opened in July of 2014, you know, a month or so after having been open. The protests, the Umbrella Revolution in Hong Kong began, and there were a few interesting ways in which the exhibition kind of interacted with that. Someone brought in an umbrella that they had created in support of that movement and left it in the gallery.
So please don't touch and kind of be really mindful of your bags.
That umbrella now forms part of the permanent collection at the V&A. It was shown to me by Karina Gardner, Senior Curator of Design and Digital, down in the rather noisy bowels of the V&A.
This is the storage space that is shared between a number of the collections, including our own.
I invited along Chung Ching Kwong, a protester in 2014 and 2019, who now lives in London and works for the Interparliamentary Alliance on China. We gathered round the box containing the umbrella.
This is clearly very nostalgic. I didn't think I would see this in London after leaving Hong Kong and not being able to return. And this is, for a lot of us, the beginning of our activist's career or participation in politics.
And what was the point of the umbrellas? I mean, they were to protect from tear gas, to protect from the police.
At the time in 2014, on the 28th of
September, the police fired tear gas at peaceful protesters outside of the government headquarters. And at the time, a lot of us don't have any kind of understanding of what to do. So the thing that we have in our hands are umbrellas. So we open all of them, and that became a symbol of the 2014 movement. That's why it's called the Umbrella Movement.
And interestingly, it's actually just a cheap, full-length umbrella, the sort that you see on sale everywhere in Hong Kong. In case there's a sudden shower, people dash in and buy one. And yet it's been adapted, it's been decorated. We can see that Chinese characters have been drawn on it in yellow paint. Karina, how did this come into the collection of the V&A?
This is an object that we've brought into the museum as part of our rapid response collecting program, which is about bringing design things into the museum at the time when they are the subject of popular conversation. So we were in touch with an academic based in Hong Kong. He went round to some of the protest sites and picked up two umbrellas from a recycling point. And he managed to reach Simon, who was the young student activist behind this set of umbrellas painted with these yellow symbols. This one, I think, has the symbol of Kang on it, which I think is to persevere or to endure.
Sometimes the most unlikely object can achieve deep symbolism. It's a stuffed toy, the sort that IKEA sells.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Lots of to children. It's a not particularly fierce wolf in a red check shirt, and he's holding a small grandma, which he's about to swallow. So obviously from the Little Red Riding Hood, and we should say, I think these were sold in IKEAs around the world, but they became so important in Hong Kong. Cheng Cheng, can you explain what we're looking at here?
This is a childhood memory. I mean, it's called Du Sik in Cantonese Lo Mo Sai. The reason why it became a symbol for the Hong Kong movement is because Lo Mo Sai, it sounds similar to a Cantonese swear word, which I'm not going to repeat in English. And at the time when CY Leung was our chief executive, which is the leader of the city, someone threw this stuffed toy at him. And that act of throwing in Cantonese is dao. So in Cantonese in full, it's like something impolite being done to your mom. Since then, it became a symbol of expressing discontent towards the administrative branch of the city. I used to have one of these at home as well. And I had a nephew and he was asking me, what is that? And I told him in Cantonese, oh, this is called lusik. And so he went on and repeating it in front of all of my grown-up relatives. And they're all looking at me very unapprovingly.
Karina, how did this end up in your collection?
We saw that this plush toy was becoming an object of political protest and discontent. But what we became interested in also is that this soft toy sold out very, very fast in places across the world where the Hong Kong cause and diaspora is strong, so Taiwan, but also here in London.
If you hold Lusik in Hong Kong right now, I think in around 5 to 10 minutes, you'll be surrounded by police asking you to stand down and put down or hide away the stuffed toy, or you'll be arrested for holding a seditious material. Or at least you'll have to pay a visit to the police station.
One example of perhaps why the authorities in Hong Kong are so keen to erase historical memory, images and artifacts from earlier protests is that the learnings from one generation of protesters can inform other later groups. Catherine Flood, again, the curator of 2014's Disobedient Objects.
One of the objects that we showed was a very basic tear gas mask made simply from a water bottle.
Makeshift tear gas mask. 1. Use the permanent marker to draw a U-shaped area big enough to fit your face. 2.
And we'd chosen to produce how-to guides for about 6 objects in the show to show people how they could make them themselves and to drive home that point that these objects were a living form of protest. So we had the guides for how to make your own tear gas mask.
5. Remove the 2 elastic bands and metal bridge from the surgical mask.
we found that they were being downloaded by the protesters in Hong Kong, that there were groups who were actually running workshops, using the guide to make batches of the masks, which were they were then taking out and distributing to protesters.
Carry a bottle of vinegar to soak the mouth cover before putting on the mask.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
新闻有一传媒董事会向保安局申请解冻资产。
This is Apple Daily TV, or at least it was. Apple Daily is now officially erased. One of the other items now being donated to museums and quietly being preserved are paper copies of Apple Daily. Published in Hong Kong until 2021 by Jimmy Lai, a local entrepreneur with British nationality, who was subsequently arrested. Lai, now 76, remains in prison awaiting trial. Samuel Chu, the president of the Campaign for Hong Kong and a US citizen who has had an arrest warrant out on him since 2020.
Not just the largest Chinese language newspaper that were pro-democracy and opposing the Chinese Communist Party. A newspaper that was written in Cantonese in a way that penetrated and shaped the culture in a way almost impossible to erase and eliminate from the culture that they now have to try to weaken and bury.
Its entire archive just disappeared from the internet overnight.
Louisa Lim.
That was a real moment of shock for Hong Kongers because Apple Daily was so popular. It was so much part of cultural life. You know, this is the newspaper that people used to read when they were having their dim sum with their families in restaurants. There were colonists who had written columns for that paper for 20 years and their entire archive was gone forever. So I think after that happened, people started realizing that it's not just Apple Daily. All kinds of books and films and plays and newspapers are going to be inaccessible in Hong Kong. Many of them will have to be taken down, as Apple Daily was taken down for security reasons because there were so many articles that they didn't know whether they would in future contravene the national security legislation. They didn't know what the ramifications of that would be when you're having retrospective action being taken. So they took it down. But many other news organizations and magazines and people were in a similar situation. So I think that it's a desperate attempt to preempt the forgetting or the disappearance that you know is going to come.
But ordinary Hong Kong citizens swung into action again. As well as saving and sending abroad hard copies, activists on Reddit put out a call for people to archive as many Apple Daily articles and videos as possible before it shut down. The online discussion on Reddit was intense, involving archivists all over the world. Please prioritise the period of February 2019 to now. Save the website first, as that's most likely to go down sooner. Users recommended using software called ArchiveBot to scrape Apple Daily's website. They created special Python scripts. They uploaded saved videos to archive.org and the cloud. Let's not pretend that over the last couple of centuries there's only ever been one version of Hong Kong history. Looking back, longer than just the last decade, Hong Kong's history has always been contested and argued over.
The British idea of Hong Kong history is that before the British arrival in the 1840s, Hong Kong was a barren rock. It was literally an empty place, a sort of tabula rasa with a few fishing villages and windblown trees and nothing else. Even at the time, this wasn't true. Hong Kong had thousands of residents and had thriving fishing villages, a history that went back thousands of years. But I think it was a convenient explanation for the British that really only as the British saw it came into being with the British arrival. China's view of Hong Kong is very different, that it has been Chinese territory since time immemorial, and that it was wrenched away from China by British force, by gunboat diplomacy, and that's why Hong Kong's return was so important. So these two versions of Hong Kong history are almost schizophrenically different.
For years, local people had visited the Hong Kong Museum of History in Tsim Sha Tsui and its exhibit called The Hong Kong Story.
Hong Kong hadn't had a history museum of its own. And it was really only in the 1980s that the government decided it was time to tell Hong Kong's story. How to tell Hong Kong's story turns out to be a political project of its own. And I think it actually took them 6 years because the committees of historians spent so long figuring out how to tell that history.
So although the museum's exhibit was never the full story, Hong Kongers raised their eyebrows when in 2020 it was announced it would be closing for renovation. And then a strange thing happened.
When they said they were going to close the museum, it became like a site of protest. So many people went taking photos, people were posting pictures online. And I think it's almost like present nostalgia for the moment, which is right now, because you know that it's passing and it's never going to come back. When that museum reopens, the kind of history that's going to be shown is going to be totally different. And there's almost like a fear of gaslighting what was up here before. What was the history that we were taught before? Can we even remember it? Or do we need these pictures to remind us of what used to be here?
At the time of recording in July 2024, the story of Hong Kong remains closed for renovation. Museums have become a front in the memory wars. Before it opened in November 2021, Hong Kong's impressive new M+ Museum removed Ai Weiwei's photograph of Tiananmen Square to be reviewed by the authorities. The photograph, which depicts the Chinese dissident artist raising his middle finger in Beijing's Tiananmen Square, was accused of spreading hatred against China under, once more, the national security law. The removal was, to be honest, not a great surprise to anyone. Similarly so with sculptures, none more so than the Pillar of Shame on the grounds of Hong Kong University. Samuel Chu.
Any mentioning of Tiananmen was erased in the mainland. And so Hong Kong was for many years the only piece of Chinese soil where Tiananmen Square was commemorated publicly.
The Pillar of Shame by Danish artist Jens Galschiøt was a striking statue commemorating the Tiananmen massacre, represented as a pile of corpses.
This artwork was always meant to be not just a piece of history or a memorial, but a political tactic. The canary in the coal mine to test the extent to which that the Chinese Communist Party would respect the very deal that they themselves agreed to. And every year, there would be a ritual where students and other civil society leaders and Hong Kong Alliance leader would come in and they would hand wash this pillar as a ritual memorial. But that came to an end when in the darkest of night, at the end of December in 2021, they came in and cut the pillar in half and removed it. A piece of the pillar wrapped in white cloth was carried like a coffin, like a body, out of the square, the plaza where it stood for all those years. And I think that that is one of the most powerful image of this attempt to erase the memory, but also the idea. What they have done now is that by removing it, they have made it much more powerful.
Talking with the Hong Kong exile Chung Ching Kuang, she perhaps inevitably quoted George Orwell and 1984, when Winston Smith repeats the party's mantra, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." Music, bookstores, libraries, museums, the classroom, art galleries, public art, objects from umbrellas to poor little Lufsig, have all become fault lines in the new memory wars to be argued over, erased as inconvenient to a new historical narrative. With the new school curriculum, young minds have become the latest battleground.
We have a very specific window of time here where multiple generations in Hong Kong who have been baptized in the experience, in the firsthand participation of protests and remember the Tiananmen Square march in the street themselves, that they have been through this baptism of activism that they have internalized. That generation is particularly important because what is the first thing that the Chinese government do after they ban the vigil? Is that they ban the mentioning of Tiananmen Square in any classrooms. In fact, they teach down to first grade, second graders that the mere mentioning of Tiananmen Square would constitute a national security crime.
Beijing and the Hong Kong government know that the generation of people in their 20s and above are probably lost to them. So let's focus all of our efforts on the young. And so you see most of the changes happening within primary schools and within secondary schools and so on. That kind of age group, they're pushing really, really hard. The fact that you're going to have to sing the Chinese national anthem every morning in schools now and stuff like that, I think will have a big impact.
And as journalist Shabani Mattani reminds us, what has also happened under the national security law is the creation of a climate of fear.
The thing that's been so hard to see is how many people in Hong Kong, for their own sort of mental health, need to forget, because it's so hard to reconcile what happened in 2019, how empowered people felt, how supported people felt, how much they felt like they had a sense of community with what's going on today, where people feel incredibly isolated, incredibly scared, too afraid to play a song because they worry their neighbors will rat on them, too afraid to have their kids be honest in schools or in class because they worry they will get into trouble and their families will get into trouble. And I think a lot of people actually want to forget because remembering is so hard. Because if you remember, how can you survive day to day? And I know people really, really struggle with that, right? Going back to like walking past protest sites, feeling like it's just too much to bear because of how little space there is to really do anything, making it just so painful for people to remember.
Samuel Chu is more optimistic.
By trying to eliminate and push down a generation and generations of freedom fighters, they have actually created the optimal environment to keep alive not only the history, but the aspiration and the innate desire for people to be free. That's, for me, is what the fight and the struggle that we're in now.
There's this real attempt to stop any kind of dissent, any kind of criticism, anything which departs in any way from that sort of single story, the single history. This is a state that's very brittle, it's very fearful, and that fear is radiating outwards as Hong Kongers go and live in other countries. We're just seeing more and more attempts to stop any acts of dissent, no matter where they are in the world. The attempt to shut down debate and discourse and memory is moving outwards, it's going international, and it will affect us.
Sometimes the battlefields of the memory wars could not appear more ordinary. Boring street photos of road markings, traffic lights, a 7-Eleven, a McDonald's. But in many cases following the protests, these sites became, to many Hong Kongers, meaningful reminders of history, despite their pedestrian, everyday ordinariness. Mary Hui.
Well, I'm a hobbyist photographer. I like to walk around the city and snap some shots. And I feel great urge to do that and to take more photos because I know that things will look very different. Or the sensation of that particular street will look different even a month or a year from now. And to be able to capture it, even in a mediocre photo, I think is kind of an important act of trying to preserve a certain kind of memory. There's this palpable sense of urgency among people trying to hold on to traces of the past. Things are changing very quickly and being erased at a fast pace.
There are artists that are doing walks around Hong Kong where they're literally videoing the most mundane strolls around the city, but that's also driven by that same urge to capture the moment, because the moment and the city and the place is being changed all the time, and we're never going to get those moments back.
This has been Erasing Hong Kong, the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul French, and the producer was Mark Berman.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.